Welcome back to His Time on Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news. I know you've been hearing it here this morning, and a little bit more coming your way in the next hour as well with John chapter 6, verses 1 to 21. And I got to say, he probably is a favorite guest of mine, although I tell you, God, we have a lot of good pastors in this, and most of these guests, you know, they're phenomenal. But Brian Wolfmuller is a personal friend and always fun to go back and forth off each other, give each other a little heat as well. Laugh at ourselves more than anything else. That's good, right? I think it is. Don't take yourself too seriously, but take the word of God seriously. There's some show he's on that talks that way sometimes. Anyhow, John chapter 6, we're shifting directions here in John a bit, and well, it's good stuff. I'll go ahead and read it, make sure we don't run out of time. John writes in verse 1, "After this, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. And a large crowd was following him because they saw the signs that he was doing on the sick. Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat down with his disciples. Now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. Lifting up his eyes then, and seeing that a large crowd was coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, 'Where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat?' He said this to test him, for he himself knew what he would do. Philip answered him, 200 denarii would not buy enough bread for each of them to get a little.' One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, 'There is a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are they for so many?' Jesus said, 'Have the people sit down.' Now there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down, about 5,000 in number. Jesus then took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated. So also the fish, as much as they wanted. And when they had eaten their fill, he told his disciples, 'Gather up the leftover fragments, that nothing may be lost.' So they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with fragments from the 5 barley loaves left by those who had eaten. When the people saw the sign that he had done, they said, 'This is indeed the prophet who has come into the world.' Perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force and make him king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself. When evening came, his disciples went down to the sea, got into a boat, and started across the sea to Capernaum. It was now dark, and Jesus had not yet come to them. The sea became rough because a strong wind was blowing. When they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus walking on the sea and coming near the boat. And they were frightened. But he said to them, 'It is I. Do not be afraid.' Then they were glad to take him into the boat, and immediately the boat was at the land to which they were rowing." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God for it. Quite a bit of text there for us to try to cover in just 40 minutes, because you got two stories, right? You got two different pericopes, two different sections that are going on. Notice bread and water, right? Bread and water. We've already had water and light, but now this food imagery is starting to show up, and it's not going to go away. And you got this bizarre thing about the Passover just kind of thrown in there with no real explanation or tie to it, except for that you're going to see Jesus breaking bread at Passover again. Yeah. And you got this strange phenomena of him walking on water is almost a side story compared to the bigger issue of him feeding, well, an impossible number of people with an impossible amount of food. All of that we'll be looking at more closely here in this next hour with Pastor Brian Wolfmuller of Faith Lutheran Church in Aurora, Colorado. If you got a question or comment for himself or myself or about the text, you can call us anywhere in the country, toll free 1-800-730-2727. Make my Friday. Give me a call, 1-800-730-2727. Or you can tweet me at Rev Fisk, and we'll take your question or comment there in almost all circumstances. I failed one of you yesterday, and my apologies go out to you, but I think the grace survives, right? So again, John chapter 6, verses 1 to 21 on the other side of the break with Pastor Brian Wolfmuller. Just a few seconds here left. Augsburg Confession 7, our churches teach that the one holy church is to remain forever. The church is the congregation of saints in which the gospel is purely taught and the sacraments are correctly administered. For the unity of the church, it is enough to agree about the doctrine of the gospel and the administration of the sacraments. It is not necessary that human traditions, that is, rites or ceremonies instituted by men, should be the same everywhere. As Paul says, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all. You're listening to His Time on Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news. The good news is that you're the church. Jesus saved you. It's true. More of that coming your way next. His Time on Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news, supported by you listeners out there to bring this gospel to you over these airwaves, whether it's internet or radio, every single day. Right now, by looking at the text of the New Testament, making our way through the Gospel of John, we're hitting John chapter 6 this morning, and our special guest to help me make sense of it, because I can't make sense of it without some serious help from a guy like this. Brian Wolfmuller, pastor of Hope Lutheran Church in Aurora, Colorado, author of a new book, Has American Christianity Failed, from Concordia Publishing House, also on Table Talk Radio, a private podcast that airs various places in the country, and the host of Grappling on Worldview Everlasting Television. Brian, welcome to the show today.
Thank you.
It's quite a string of names you got there. If you got a question or comment for Brian or myself on John chapter 6, 1-800-730-2727. You don't have to talk about all his accolades, but he will happily point you to Jesus. You can also tweet me at Rev Fisk, and we'll try to get this text to make some sense in the places where it may or may not. So, Brian, what's up out in Aurora? Anything new happening with you and Pastor Flammy out there?
No, all's well. You know, getting ready for Lent, which is coming up here pretty soon. So that'll be great. Getting ready for a busy year. I think, you know, the newest that when they're in Aurora, come to church. It'd be great to come have you stop in and visit at Hope Lutheran. Pastor Flammy is pretty excited that this next week we're going to host a meeting of the Denver Creation Society. So all the Lutheran churches in Denver have started to get together for a Creation Society and to have various meetings at different churches to think about how we consider the Lord's work in creation, especially as it's assaulted by the ideology of evolution. And Pastor Flammy is going to present a paper on Luther's understanding of reason, which is going to be really wonderful, because we hear so much about how Luther hated reason. He talked about how reason was the whore of the devil and all this kind of stuff. But Luther also had a very, very high regard for philosophy and for reason when it's in its right place. So he's going to try to make some clean distinctions to help us there.
Yeah.
So that'll be excited on March 2nd.
March 2nd. That sounds good. At Hope Lutheran Church in Aurora.
Yep.
So if you're in the Denver area, make sure you think about checking that out. You can probably find information at the church website. What's the church website?
hope-aurora.org.
There you go. So John chapter 6, we got quite a set of stories here, with no real chance, at least in our study on the radio, to explain them, because we're going to miss most of the conversation that happens afterwards. What do we need to know? And you can also just in general talk about, you know, John. What makes John special? What do we need to know if we just dive in here that we maybe wouldn't know on our own?
Well, what's really interesting is that this miracle, the feeding of the 5,000, is the only miracle apart from the resurrection that's recorded in all four Gospels, at least that I can find. It makes it a really unique thing that it cuts through all the Gospels. It's not unique. Most of the stuff in John is very unique to John. He is filling in the gaps where Matthew, Mark, and Luke don't tell us all the things that we need to know. Don't give us all the details. In fact, the ancient church historian Eusebius says that the church was asking John the apostle who wrote John to write it for years and years and years, and he wouldn't. But there was just some things that were, you know, that they couldn't fit together. So, for example, it's from John that we know that Jesus' ministry was 3.5 years and not just one. We know that the disciples were called and then they went back to work and then they were called again. John loves to give us the teaching and preaching of Jesus so that these things are explained, so that while Matthew, Mark, and Luke have this miracle, it's John who has the bread of life discourse that follows in this chapter that explains what's going on, that teaches the significance of the sign of this miracle.
When you see, again, following up after the walking on water, the controversy that this thing causes as well, right, which the other gospel writers don't get into quite as much. It's kind of tough to break this story apart, and we just did read it, but I think I probably should just read it again, and then we can dive into the deeper meaning of the meat stuff, or the bread.
Sure.
The bread, but... After this, Jesus went to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. A large crowd was following him because they saw the signs that he was doing on the sick. Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat down with his disciples. The Passover feast of the Jews was at hand. Lifting up his eyes then and seeing that a large crowd was coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat?" Now, it would be easy to jump over those first four verses because they just seem to be fluff a little bit, right? But you got him going around Galilee. You got this bit about Tiberias being thrown in. Why is that there? Why is he giving you the alternate name? You got this large crowd, but notice, why are they there? They're just for the signs, which is kind of one of the John's things, working with that word sign, and then also what is faith, what is not faith. You have him sitting on a mountain right after you just had a pericope in which he's talking about you don't listen to Moses. So you got this guy on a mountain thing going on. And then you got a bit about the Passover being there that he never really explains what this has to do with anything. And then the question, why is Jesus not in the temple? Why is he not down at Jerusalem for the Passover? But John kind of leaves that behind and then just says, look, he sees a large crowd of people and he wants to feed them, but he's going to test his disciples too, right? Verse 6, he said this to test him, for he himself knew what he would do. I mean, you could probably spend an hour just on that, but, you know, with 3-5 minutes here, what do you think?
Yeah, there is a lot of things going on. So this is, the Galilee and Tiberias thing is a hint, and this, John will do this a lot, that John is writing for a non-Hebrew audience, especially for a non-Jewish audience, an audience in dispersion. He's probably writing this in Asia, where he was in Ephesus. He was caretaker of Mary, mother of Jesus, for a while. He was bishop of Ephesus, exiled to Patmos back in Ephesus there, and so he's writing for this Gentile audience. So he's giving also the Gentile Latin name, so people know where it is. But the setup, and we see it here, and especially in Mark, but the setup is really painting the picture of Psalm 23. So the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. So you have the people there. They're by the water, the Sea of Galilee, Lake of Tiberias, and they're going to sit down on the green grass, and the Lord is going to be their shepherd and is going to take care of them. So that while Moses, you know, remember Moses was called from shepherding the sheep to shepherding the Lord's people. David was called from shepherding the sheep to shepherding the Lord's people. So that these were pictures of the Lord's care for the people. But now Jesus is entering into that office, and he's going to be the one who will take care of them.
That's so good that you bring up both Moses and David there, and that you have both of their titles showing up here as well, right? The prophet, which is Moses' own prophecy about a prophet who would come, and then Jesus is going to perceive they're going to make him king, which is David. So you do have a Moses David thing. What about the testing, right? So he says to Philip, "Where are we going to buy this bread?" He said it to test him, for he knew what he would do.
I'm always tempted. I don't know if this is a healthy temptation or not, but I'm always tempted to see Jesus and all of the things that he's doing as the chief object of all of his works are the disciples themselves. And he's shaping them into the office so that they'd be pastors and teachers and evangelists and apostles to start the church. And so he's gonna feed the people. He's gonna take care of the people. He can't not do it. I mean, he's driven by his compassion to care for people, even when it's inconvenient. I mean, he's all, so that Jesus, when he's always pressed out of cities, and he's always up all night, and he's always doing all these things that it seems like he's kind of resistant to do, but he can't help himself. The people come and pray, and he's going to heal them. He came to teach and to preach and to die and to be raised, but in the meantime, whenever he sees something broken, he's going to fix it. And he says, don't tell anybody, because I got to preach. Don't tell anybody. But they go and tell everyone, and the crowds press in, and they say, all right, now we got to go, because I came to preach. So Jesus knows what he's going to do. He's going to take care of the people. He can't help himself. He's driven by his own compassion, but he's going to take advantage of this, of the miracle, to also teach his disciples, and to teach them this, that Jesus is the one who answers their prayer for daily bread.
Hmm.
I mean, I think before we look at the spiritual meaning of the text, there is a very practical first article sort of thing. Jesus feeds us. Luther will, who loves to preach this text, will say things like, look, never has a Christian died of starvation. That the Lord will take care. I mean, there's other ways that you can die, but never that the Lord will take care of our physical needs. He will do it. He's promised to do it. He taught us to pray, give us this day our daily bread, and he'll answer that prayer.
Yeah, that was in the psalm reading for this morning as well. I've never seen the righteous or his children go in without bread. And it's sort of like it's one of those things that tests the faith a little bit, right? And, you know, do I kind of really believe that? Can I really trust this worldly promise? And yet here it is, Jesus doing that and demonstrating his power over creation in both of these stories, right? That the bread and the water are his. They have nothing over and against him. So,
you see, our stomach is always tempting us to this fear, right?
Yeah.
This is the thing with the fear of God, right? That it casts out all other fears. So we were talking about this yesterday, thinking about it, that the way that Luther describes Adam and Eve before the fall is that they weren't afraid of anything. They weren't afraid of death. They weren't afraid of sickness. They weren't afraid of the lion. Now, it helped that there was nothing to be afraid of. But even if there was something to be afraid of, they wouldn't be afraid of it.
Hmm.
Because they had the fear of God, which casts out all other fears. But we have so many things that come to us and say, hey, you should fear me.
Hmm.
Now, our stomach is that thing in excess. It comes to us and says, hey, you should be afraid of me being empty. That should drive you. And when we look at our schedule, I mean, it's amazing to think about how much of our time, our effort, our works, our schedule, everything is bent towards taking care of our stomach.
Yeah.
And Jesus is assaulting that idolatry. He says the pagans, you know, their God is their stomach, not you Christians.
Philip's answer isn't quite in that direction, but it's close enough. Philip answered him, 200 denarii worth of bread would not be enough for each of them to get a little, right? Like there's no way to possibly serve their stomachs. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, there is a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are they for so many? And Jesus said, have the people sit down. So is Andrew mocking, right? Is he kind of like whatever, or is he just kind of confused and like, well, here we could try. And Philip clearly just is got the fear and unbelief that is in our flesh.
Yeah. I don't know why Jesus goes specifically after Philip.
But yeah, right.
A direct question to him. And then Andrew's, I mean, maybe Andrew feels sympathy for Philip because Philip's floundering around. He's like, and then Andrew kind of says, well, we got 5 loaves. But
yeah, what do we do with that?
Yeah. So that they're kind of coming to the, you know, it's kind of, it kind of reminds you of the Transfiguration when Peter kind of says, well, build 3 tabernacles, you know. What are you talking about, Peter? I mean, this is kind of it's like, Andrew, what are you talking about? But Jesus is going to take the what are you talking about?
Yeah,
and gonna take care of all the people. It's great.
Yeah, he makes them to lie down. Right? Jesus said, "Have the people sit down." Now there was much green grass in the place. There's your Psalm 23 reference. So the men sat down, and it does say men there, and it's translated as men. We don't always do that, I think, unfortunately. But you know, this is an important point. There's 5,000 men. So if you got women and children too, this is just a host of people, about 5,000 in number. Jesus then took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, very familiar language there, he distributed them to those who were seated, so also the fish, as much as they wanted. And when they had eaten their fill, he told the disciples, "Gather up the leftover fragments that nothing may be lost." So they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with fragments from the barley loaves left by those who had eaten. So but before we get to the fragments, I got a question there about that. But before we get to the fragments, anything else on the text?
Well, it's no. I mean, it's a familiar text. So and the miracle is here, and it's plain. I mean, maybe one thing that's not about the text, but about would fit in here, is that there's a lot of people who there's a classic liberal explanation of this text, which we should just call absurd as it is, and that is that it goes something like this: when the people saw this little boy sharing his little barley loaves, they were all so moved that they also pulled out their lunches and started sharing. And so that's the liberal way to do it. Another, I've heard this, that there was a cave filled with bread, and Jesus, the disciples were handing it to Jesus, and he kept handing it out. Now, this is, of course, ridiculous. The reason why people want to come up with these stupid explanations of the miracles is they don't believe miracles are possible. And they look back and they say, oh, the people were so stupid back then that they didn't know miracles were possible.
Right.
Well, of course the people knew that miracles were impossible. That's why they called them miracles, and that's why they were amazed by it. So that the fact that the text gives it to us like it is invites us to trust that, no, this is Jesus. He can do anything he wants, and this is what he wants to do. Take five loaves and feed 5,000 men and women and children on top of that. It's great.
I love the story and the picture here of a man holding a piece of bread, walking and breaking off, I imagine, a decent-sized chunk and handing it to somebody. And, like, what's going on with that bread as his hand is moving to the other person? Like, is the bread growing back? Is it just sort of, like, there and, like, no one realized does it not break and just is permanently? I mean, my brain can't fathom, you know, what's going on. Beyond it being a physical miracle, it's an intellectual miracle. And what is, I think, tremendously important in this is that most of the modern arguments against Jesus being present in physical form as body and blood in the Lord's Supper go along the lines of a human body can't do that. And so, therefore, Jesus would deny his humanity by getting into the supper somehow. And my question is, was this then not bread, right? Because bread can't do this. It's impossible. Fish can't do this. And we're going to get to this. Actually, we should just go this down. You get to this point where he has more bread at the end than he does at the beginning. But I'm gonna let Chris go and ask what he wants to ask. Chris is calling in from Spring, Texas. Got a question about gathering up the leftovers. Chris, welcome.
Oh, hi. Thanks for having me on the show.
Absolutely.
Well, when I was reading the passage, the thing that stood out to me was that it says he gathered up the leftover fragments that none may be lost. And that was quite intriguing to me because that never stood out to me before. And I thought, is this somehow connected to Jesus and, you know, the lost sheep and all that kind of lost stuff where it's like he came to seek and save the lost. He came to make sure that those who are his. And maybe it's a total crazy connection, but it stood out to me this time.
Brian?
I think Jesus uses almost the exact same language in his high priestly prayer at the end of John. None that were given to me shall be lost, except the son of perdition. So there's a parallel in the language, and I think it's good that we would think that way. Now here at first we want the text to stand on the history, and so that Jesus says, "Hey, gather all this stuff up, and let's see what we got there." And these 12 baskets are gathered up so that they would serve as the sign, so that the disciples and all the people there would look at these 12 baskets, and they would see that they would see that. They would see how things started. You have the five barley loaves, and you have 1,000 starving people. And then at the end, you have 5,000 satisfied, full, content people and 12 baskets. That's the sign that Jesus is putting before the people. And they're supposed to remember it. I mean, the disciples are supposed to remember it. There's another instance that happens just a few weeks later where there's 4,000 people in the wilderness. And Jesus is there, and there's 7 loaves, and the disciples say, "What are we going to do?" And Jesus says, "Don't you remember the 5 loaves? Don't you remember the 12 baskets? You're supposed to remember this." especially when the devil comes to tempt you to think that God has abandoned you and he's going to let you starve. Remember these baskets. So that's the first reason. But then that Jesus has this great care that none are lost is phenomenally comforting to us. I mean, we think of, I don't know, to kind of make the application, oftentimes in our prayers, we might be ashamed to ask for the little things because they seem like the kind of the scraps that nobody would care about. And we want to pray only for the big things. But we see in this that Jesus he's caring about the little stuff, about the scraps, about the, you know, the things that you think you could just leave there in the wilderness for the birds to eat. And Jesus says, no, pick them up. And when we think that we're just the scraps that the Lord should leave off, Jesus has the same thing for us. No, grab them up. Keep them. None shall be lost from my hands.
Thanks for the question, Chris. Always appreciative of the live phone-in call. You're listening to His Time on Worldwide KFUO. We're going to pick it up right there on the other side of this break with Pastor Brian Wolfmuller, John chapter 6. Stick around.
How do we legally protect the rights of LGBTQ people without infringing on religious liberty or compromising our beliefs about sex and gender? Friday on Issues Etc., we'll talk with Ryan Anderson of the Heritage Foundation about sexual orientation and gender identity policies, and we'll play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week.
Issues Etc. Live weekday afternoons from 3 to 5 on KFUO.
Winter in cold climates can feel long and dark. Hope, music, and light all help. A radio program can't do much about the light except spiritual light, and you will find that, along with plenty of music and hope on the next Sing for Joy.
Sundays at noon on KFUO, the messenger of good news.
The thought of my sons growing up without me inspired me to quit smoking.
I talked to my doctors, and then I threw away all my cigarettes, ashtrays, and lighters.
I started exercising instead of smoking.
Staying away from alcohol when I was first quitting was key.
I kept on trying, learned something each time.
Do whatever it takes.
No matter how many times it takes.
We did it, so can you.
For free help, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and CDC.
Our Give Now button at KFUO.org is available 24 hours a day. Also, you can send email to gifts@KFUO.org and ask for information about our various giving opportunities. To call and talk to someone today, contact Mary at 314-996-1518 or Mark Hawkinson at 314-996-1520. Support the mission of Worldwide KFUO and help us reach the world with the gospel.
Welcome back to His Time on Worldwide KFUO. I'm your host, Pastor Jonathan Fist, talking with Pastor Brian Wolfmuller about John chapter 6, and we're going to keep moving as fast as we can because we don't want to leave any of this text behind. We left off verse 13 of John 6, where they gather up and fill 12 baskets with fragments from the 5 barley loaves left by those who had eaten. When the people saw the sign that he had done, they said, "This is indeed the prophet who has come is to come into the world." I don't want to skip over or go too fast past the 12 baskets. Again, we already did talk about it a little bit, but there is certainly room for debate or disagreement on this. But the number 12 is a pretty important number in the Bible. It is the number of the sons of Israel. It is the number of the apostles. It is the number of the foundations of the heavenly Jerusalem. It has, for that reason, been seen through Christian history as a symbolic number, the number of the church itself. And that doesn't mean that this didn't happen literally. That's where sort of the liberal thing comes in, where you want to say, well, it's because it's being used symbolically, therefore it's not real. No, clearly there was 12 baskets left over. And yet, Jesus had total power over this, and he chose to have 12 baskets left over. That's what he did. And as you talked earlier, Pastor Wolfmuller, about none being lost, and the church being those whom we are the scraps that God will not let be thrown away, I can't help but be encouraged even by that number 12 there. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, when John hears the number of the church in the revelation given to him, it's 144,000,
right?
12,000 from each of the 12 tribes. You get the picture of these are the baskets all filled up. Perfect.
That's beautiful. So what about this prophet coming into the world?
Yeah, this is, we should know this. Deuteronomy 18, 18, verse 15 and then verse 18 in Deuteronomy is one of the few times in the five books of Moses where you get these, you get a prophecy that we're used to hearing, like in the Psalms or in Isaiah or Amos or Micah or, you know, the, some of the direct Psalms that speak of Jesus, that he'll be born of a virgin, that he will, that he'll be born in Bethlehem, all this kind of stuff that we, that the New Testament loves to quote. We have, we don't have many of those in Moses. In fact, I would suggest that probably we don't have any. Genesis 3:15 we point to a lot, and that's definitely Moses, but it's before Moses was around. But this one is from Moses, where he says, the Lord will raise up a prophet like you, like Moses, from among your brethren. So we have a specific promise pointing directly to Jesus, and that is what's running in the background behind this. So this is the prophet. There's lots of prophets, but this is the one, the prophet like unto Moses, that the Lord is going to raise up from his brethren. Him you should hear. It's when Jesus, at Jesus' baptism and at the transfiguration, when the Lord says, hear him, this is an echo of the same promise, Deuteronomy 18, 18. It can't be, you know, we can't give that too little importance in our mind.
Yeah,
so that's great.
It seems to me, and I don't know if this is just, it could be the fault of the lectionary and Advent texts, or it could be the fault of American Christianity, but it seems to me that this particular prophecy is kind of underrated, that we look at it, we want to prove Jesus was prophesied to come. We look at Isaiah, right? We look at Joel. We go to all these places. But for the Hebrew mind in the first century, the prophet, I mean, this was the big thing, right? This is even maybe bigger than David. It was that Moses had said, there's going to come one, and when he comes, it's all going to work out. And here, well, they're asking. This is not asking, they're saying, this is it, right? Here he is. Yep. This is big when they say that.
We cannot think too highly of Moses if we're trying to think like a Jewish person who's expecting the Messiah. You know, I mean, Moses, of all the heroes of the Old Testament, Moses is the one. And when you just, you know, sit down and read your Bible, Moses is different. I mean, even once you get to the end of Deuteronomy and you start getting into Joshua, you're like, wait a minute, this has got a different, there's something different going on here, because Moses is really phenomenal as he unfolds what the heaven on earth ought to look like in the worship of the Lord's people. And so you're right. This is important.
Perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king. How many men could you say that about? Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself. So a little epilogue to the story before we move into the walking on water. Any thoughts there?
And this is the point. Jesus won't be this kind of king. They want a bread king, and that's not his king. His cross will be of thorns. His crown will be of thorns. His throne will be his cross. He won't be any other kind of king. So when they come to make him king by force so that they can give him bread, he won't do it. This is what the Caesars do, you know. They're the ones that throw out the cakes. Let them eat cakes. That's the Caesar king, but not Jesus. He's a different kind of king.
And it reminds me of earlier in the book where he will not entrust himself to a man because he knows what is in a man. And he knows that this is not faith. He has not created faith yet. The resurrection has to happen for that really to take place. It's not that they don't hope or that they don't have the inkling or the Spirit's not working, but there's something missing here. And he cannot, it's almost the temptation, right? I will give you all the kingdoms of the world. He cannot take this without undoing what he must really do.
You see the temptation parallel here, turning the stone into bread,
right?
And then becoming king of the nation. So there's But you see how Jesus handles the temptations differently when he's by himself versus when he's with the people that he has compassion on. He never can serve himself, but he will serve these people.
Right. Yeah. So then evening comes, verse 16, his disciples went down to the sea, got into a boat and started across the sea to Capernaum, like without Jesus. John doesn't bother to tell us why. I think the other gospel writers tell us that Jesus tells them to do it. It was now dark and Jesus had not yet come to them. It's like, why are they leaving him? It's so weird. The sea became rough because a strong wind was blowing. The Sea of Galilee was big. I mean, this was no lake, right? This sucker was huge. And it actually was party to some pretty extreme storms that would come in off the Mediterranean, and they could really get rough. When they had rowed for about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus walking on the sea and coming near the boat, and they were frightened. Again, how weird is this? Like, he just disappears. They leave. It gets crazy. And then he's like, yeah, I'll just take a walk on the water. What the heck, you know? And then they see him, and they're like, what's going on? Which I guess makes sense, but other Gospels can tell us they think he's a ghost because the sea was a place of demons and so forth. It's kind of a mythology of the Hebrew mind. But he says to them, it is I, right? Do not be afraid. And so often the message of Christ to everyone and his angels as well, right? Fear not, fear not. And they were glad to take him into the boat, and immediately the boat was to the land to which they were going. Again, it's hard not to think that John is taking a true history and then molding it to give you this metaphor, this symbol of, you know, Christ ascends to the mountain, to heaven, and we see the storm around us, and it seems awful, and we try to row where we ought to go, and we could never get there. But then here he comes majestically, miraculously returning, says, fear not, and everything's where it's supposed to be. We're in the land we're headed to. Now, maybe that's really just extreme of me to allegorize that there, but golly, it's like John's doing it on purpose.
Yeah, he is. He is. Now, there's a couple of, he leaves things out of this incident, which is interesting also. I mean, that Peter comes out of the boat and also walks on the water, that he starts to sink, that Jesus, when he gets into the boat, immediately the storm is calmed, that they reach the other side. And then, and we have a second miracle that happens on the sea, apart from this one. That's where Jesus is in the boat, and the waves are coming in to kill them, and Jesus is asleep.
Right.
And then he gets up and he rebukes the waves. So you have two major miracles on the Sea of Galilee that demonstrate this. I mean, the first thing it demonstrates is that Jesus is God, and that he is God in our flesh. So he's walking. I mean, he's walking on the water, but he's walking in his humanity. And then he has power over nature. These things that, you know, there are all these things that are out of our own control, that our will does not extend to. It would have before the fall. We would have had dominion over these sorts of things, but that dominion was lost. So we have all these fears that go around us, but Jesus is in Christ is the restoration of the dominion over creation to humanity. And that's being demonstrated here, that Jesus is just walking on the water, that he calms the waves, that the things that look like they're going to destroy the disciples are to Jesus absolutely nothing.
You also, again, to come back to this, can the Lord's Supper be the Lord's Supper thing, which might seem like an extreme jump, except for that there's going to be a lot of talk about eating flesh and blood coming up here. I don't think that John 6 is narrowly the institution of the Lord's Supper, but I think that John is messing with our minds a bit and challenging us to believe in the impossible when God says it is so. And the Jesus walking on water is another example of this, that Jesus is making the water do things it can't do, or Jesus is doing with his body things human bodies don't normally do. And there's a really fascinating little tidbit out of Calvin's Institutes. John Calvin, kind of the real father, at least systematically, of Zwinglian sacramentarianism, the belief that that Jesus is only spiritually or symbolically present in the Lord's Supper. And when Calvin gets to this part where he's talking about Jesus walking on water, he literally does make the claim that the way it happens is that Jesus changes the water to make it walkable. It's not that his body is actually walking on water. He has to change the water. And it shows you where Calvin's mind is on this need to, like, not let his reason die in Jesus. And I don't want to condemn Calvin. He's like the rest of us, an idolater of his own mind. We all are. But you really kind of see it. It's like, well, no. I mean, why do you have to say that? Why can't it just be a miracle?
The Lutherans used to talk about the translocal presence of Jesus, and that is the way that he can interact with this world in a different way. And they'll say things like, he used this mode of being when he walked through the grave, the wall of the grave,
right?
After and on the resurrection, he used this translocal mode of being when he walked on the water, when he walked through the crowd that came to grab him to make him king at the end of the Bread of Life discourse, and in other times, and so that Jesus can be present according to his body and his blood in a different way than we know of being present, because his body and blood is united to his divine nature.
Right.
So you're right to connect this this trans-local mode of presence here with the fact that Jesus can put his body and blood in the bread and wine on the altar if he wants to do it.
You mentioned, I kind of missed, I got a couple of those. Did you mention the upper room as well?
No, but that's it, when he appears at the resurrection.
Right,
he
walks the because wall. That's another place where in Calvin's Institutes, he has a little aside there that there was a window or a door the disciples did not know about. And it's one of those places where you're like, you know, I really respect John Calvin. I think he was a masterful mind. You must contend with his theology. There's no way to ignore him. And his Institutes is a huge, huge set of books. And so I'm just picking on like two little tiny lines. But what strange decisions, what strange beliefs to have Jesus appear in the upper room, manifesting his glory of resurrection, scars in his side, right, that are no longer bleeding. And yet it couldn't have been that he just did it. It's got to be, it gets back to that thing you were saying earlier, the liberal tendency to want to explain the miracle and not believe it, which Calvin would, go ahead.
Calvin would do it in order to protect his doctrine of the Lord's Supper.
That's
right?
It.
And so you see, the sacraments are really where all of our theology comes together. If we get them right, then everything else starts to fall into place.
So with like 2 minutes left here, we're not going to get into any of this I am the bread of life discourse, but you want to kind of bring us all the way up to chapter to verse 50?
Well, so yeah, I think we can do it really quickly because Jesus is going to, the topic of conversation that's going to happen next is a comparison between Jesus and manna. And the manna that Moses fed the people with in the wilderness is brought into our minds here as this great miracle, and it's Jesus is going to say, I'm the one that fed you when you were in the wilderness. I'm the one that gave you the manna. It wasn't Moses. I gave the bread to Moses to give to you. And he'll say, I am the bread of life that comes down from heaven. Now, the picture of it, what Jesus is teaching when he's saying that is the incarnation, that all the other bread comes up from the earth, you know, just the wheat grows from the dirt, and there it is. And all of us, our humanity comes from Adam and comes from our mom and dad like this. But Jesus is a different man. He is our brother, real human flesh and blood. But he is the one who descended to the earth, and he comes to rescue us. So just like the supernatural bread that came down from heaven, so is Jesus, the Son of God, come down from heaven into our humanity. And as the apostle or the Nicene Creed says it so beautifully, he did this for us and for our salvation. He came down to save us.
My guest, Pastor Brian Wolfmuller of Hope Lutheran Church in Aurora, Colorado, talking about John chapter 6, author of a book you really should pick up, Has American Christianity Failed, from Concordia Publishing House. And also, you can find that on his, what's the website they should go to look for all your other stuff you do?
Wolfmuller.co. Just remember, I couldn't afford the M, so Wolfmuller.co.
And you can probably sign up there as well for his Wednesday Whatnot, a weekly mailing where he gives you five kind of tidbits of what he's reading or what other people that are smarter than him are saying, which he's always fond of sharing. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely check out all that out there if you haven't seen his stuff. Thanks, Brian.
You got it.
So Jesus is here among us to do something very important, and it is not give us just bread, right? A bread king is not enough. You can have a full belly and you're still going to end up in the grave. You're still going to end up dead. Jesus has to give us a better kind of bread, a manna, a what is it? A bread from heaven that does not decay on the next day, but instead abides forever and lasts forever. What is that thing? It's himself. And all of these miracles, all of this story is teaching his disciples to believe that. And you see in them what you should see in yourself, just how set against believing the wisdom of God's real word you actually are, as they struggle and they're confused and they just can't come to trust. But then this Jesus is such a God, such a man, such a king, that he's not going to just save you because you trust him. He's going to prove to you that he is trustworthy. He's going to save you by being trustworthy for you. And in that way, it is his goal not to leave you forsaken and hungry, but filled to the brim and overflowing with life eternal. You're listening to His Time on Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news. My second conversation with some of our friends from Latvia coming your way next.